From the NBC University Theater, Mr. Henry Hull in The Ides of March by Thornton Wilder. We bring you a radio play by Brainerd Duffield and Emerson Crocker, adapted from one of last year's most provocative books, Thornton Wilder's The Ides of March. The Ides of March added new luster to the already glittering reputation of Mr. Wilder and proved a distinguished addition to a list that included such fine titles as The Bridge of San Luis Rey, The Woman of Andros, Our Town, and The Skin of Our Teeth. At the time of publication, it was the subject of much critical praise, and it was a selection of the Book of the Month Club. To star in today's radio version of The Ides of March, we are proud to have with us one of the most powerful actors of the American stage and screen, Mr. Henry Hull, and to comment on the book behind the radio play, Professor Beaumont Brustel of the University of Tulsa. Dr. Brustel's intermission commentary is recorded. Here then, The Ides of March, starring Henry Hull.
We are fortunate in having with us today as guest lecturer, Professor Willard, who has come down from State University to speak to us on aspects of ancient Rome. Professor Willard.
Thank you. I must begin by telling you that I have devoted 30 years to a study of the correspondence and memoranda of Julius Caesar. So you can imagine my astonishment when last year a vast bulk of highly interesting, I may say unique, documents came to light on the island of Capri. It would appear that they were written by Julius Caesar to his friend Lucius Mamilius Turnus in the year 45 B.C., and indeed on into the next year when they were cut short on the Ides of March. Picture with me now, if you can, that blue Mediterranean world in the last glorious days of the Roman Republic. Picture the marble temples, the dark cypresses, the splashing fountains, and so forth. This, then, is the first letter, dated August 20, the year 45 B.C. That's some 1,500 years before Columbus. It was written by Caesar, and it reads: "My dear old friend, prepare your thoughts for my guidance. It is midnight.
It is midnight. I sit alone before my window and look out on the city. I've left my wife sleeping and have tried to quiet my thoughts by reading the poetry of Lucretius. Oh, my friend, every day I feel more pressure upon me arising from the position I occupy. I am the dictator, but I think a good one. I've pacified the world. I've reformed the calendar. I've extended the benefits of Roman citizenship to innumerable men and women. Next month, torture will be removed from the penal code. Yet still, I am much hated. Oh, my friend, what are the capabilities of the human being? Man, what is that? What do we know of him? His gods, liberty, mind, love, destiny, death. What do these mean? You remember how you and I, as boys, studying in Athens, and later before our tents in Gaul, used to turn these things over endlessly. I'm an adolescent again, philosophizing. As Plato said, the best philosophers in the world are boys with their beards new on their chins. I am a boy again. But hush. There has just been a change of guard at my door. The sentries have clashed their swords and exchanged the password. The password for tonight is Caesar Watches.
The password for tonight is Caesar Watches. I think you students will see that this is rather a remarkable letter, revealing, let us say, the meditative Caesar. Yes, you have a question back there?
Sir, I'd like to ask, who was Turnus?
Who was Turnus? Well, now, we know of Turnus mostly from Caesar's History of the Belgian Wars. In the second battle with the Belgians in the year 51, the enemy captured Turnus. He had been gone 30 hours before Caesar realized he was missing. They rescued him, but he was in a pitiable state. The enemy, in order to extract information from him, had been progressively cutting off his limbs and depriving him of his senses. They had cut off an arm and a leg, perhaps more, put out his eyes, cropped his ears, and were about to burst his eardrums when Caesar rescued him. After that time, by his own wish, he lived alone in a villa on Capri, absolutely walled off. Yes, well, now, I shall go on to the second letter, dated September 3rd. My dear friend Turnus, I am putting into this week's packet to you a sheaf of poems.
I want you to tell me what you think of them. They are by a young man named Catulus, and I think the mastership of Rome more worth administering since I have seen these examples of what our Latin tongue can do. This Catulus is as eloquent in hatred as he is in love, and he seems to hate me bitterly. I don't know why. The verses I am sending are written in praise of Claudia Pulcher, that reckless woman who continues to be a daily scandal. Claudia and that abominable brother of hers have invited us to dinner. Oh, by the way, I need hardly say we are not attending. Wait, wait, wait. Someone's coming. I must lay down my pen a while. Yes, who is knocking?
It is I, nephew.
My dear Aunt Julia.
Oh, dear boy, forgive me for taking the time of the master of the world. But may I ask you one question?
As many as you like.
It's about this invitation. Claudia Pulcher and her brother have invited me to dinner on the last day of the month. And they tell me, dear boy, that you will be there, too.
My dear aunt, I have no intention of going to Claudia's dinner.
Oh? But Pompeia says that you will go.
My wife said that?
Yes, Caius.
Where is Pompeia?
Well, she's out there in the hall.
I thought as much. Pompeia, come in here, please.
You called me, did you, darling? Did you, dear?
Come here. To me.
Yes, Caius.
I thought we had decided, you and I, not to go to Claudia's reception.
Had we, Caius?
I must confess, nephew, it surprised me to hear that you were dining with that wicked woman. Why, while I was in the country, I had scandalized letters every day from Sempronia Metalla and Fulvio Manso and all the other ladies.
I don't care. I want to go to Marcy's party.
Well, really, Pompeia...
I think, Aunt Julia, you'd better let me speak to my wife alone. I thought it had been decided we wouldn't go, but I see we must discuss it further.
Just as you like, nephew. Forgive my presumption.
Pompeia, I'm going to be stern with you.
Oh, Caius.
It makes me unhappy to refuse you anything. You know that. The three or four times you have listened and agreed and accepted my reasons for not going to Claudia's dinner, you really try my patience.
You don't love me.
Darling, don't I return to you daily from my work with the most affectionate expectation? Don't I pass all the time with you that isn't devoted to my official duties? You know I do.
I don't care. I want to go to Marcy's party.
I wish you wouldn't call her by that name.
She's my Marcy.
Call her your panther or your tigress if you like, but in Jove's name, not Mousy.
Oh, are we never to have any enjoyment in our life? Any pleasure at all?
You knew very well who married me that my position did not permit the leisure and freedom that most men enjoy. Many women envy you.
Well, I don't care if they do. Every request I put to you, you refuse. I cannot go to the theater. I cannot go to the Temple of Isis and Osiris. I cannot...
It's not suitable for you to be seen in such places.
Oh, every morning we quarrel, and every night you apologize. But I never make any progress. I never get what I want.
My dear, why are you so set on going to this dreadful dinner?
Well, Marcy...
Hmm?
That is, Claudia had the loveliest dress sent me from Sorrento, and we're to dress as twins at the party, she and I. Oh, I've tried on the dress, and it's divine. It just matches my Etruscan tiara.
What other reason do you have for wanting to invade that serpent's nest?
Well, Marcy's promised to serve that Egyptian ragout of seafood, and I'm to have the sheep's head with roast apples and peaches soaked in Albanian spirits.
There's no other reason?
Why, yes, Caius, of course. The people. There'll be such lovely people there.
And who will be there?
Well, Cicero is invited, and you know how witty he is. And Marcy's brother Clodius will be there.
Yes, 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 I know he will.
Oh, and he's a terribly attractive person and so sympathetic, even though he does have such a frightful reputation with the ladies.
Pompeia, if ever I hear of your being more than barely polite to that scoundrel, I shall thrash you, divorce you, and bar you from my house.
Oh, what a thing to say. I'm sure Clodius has always been a perfect gentleman to me.
He's a beast. He's worse than his sister. Avoid him. Now, what other charming people will be there?
Oh, yes, who else? Well, there's Catullus, the young man that writes such clever poetry, and Asinius Pollio.
Well, are you sure Catullus will be there?
Of course I am.
Ah, yes.
Oh, I know he writes simply horrifying verses about you, dear, but they're awfully clever. You'll have to admit it.
Never mind, my dear. Since you've set your heart on it, well, we'll go.
May we? Oh, may we, Caius? Oh, I see it all now. Why didn't I tell you in the beginning that the poet would be there?
There. That's enough. Now run along and tell Aunt Julia your news. And write to Claudia and say that we are coming. Go along. I have a letter to finish. Where did I put that pen?
Oh, you and your letters. Goodbye, my darling Caesar. I do love you.
Well, goodbye, my dear. I have changed my mind. We shall dine at Claudia Pulcra after all. She is a woman of beauty, high birth, and conspicuous intelligence. And when I was young, I was in love with her. Besides, she will introduce me to Catullus.
And here the letter ends. Now, before I go on, are there questions? Yes?
I'd like to ask, Professor, would you tell us something about Claudia?
Claudia Pulcra. Well, she was quite notorious, you know. How many here have heard of her? Ah, yes, quite a few. And how many know the name Catullus? For the benefit of those who don't, I shall say that Catullus was a very great poet who addressed his most passionate poetry to Lady Claudia Pulcra, a blasé and dissolute woman. I suppose our modern Freudian psychologists would have an explanation for such a person. She must, sometime in her youth, have had a very unpleasant experience with a man. She led a, let us say, a highly immoral existence. But at any rate, poor Catullus seemed blind to her faults. And although she treated him most cruelly, he worshipped her and did whatever she told him. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Unfortunately, we do not have Caesar's account of Claudia's dinner party on the 30th of September. But we do have the account set down some years later by Asinius Pollio, who was also a guest that evening. In the words of Asinius Pollio,
we had been awaiting the arrival of the dictator and his party, and a large crowd had gathered outside Claudia's house to watch him pass. Then some terrified servants burst in to tell us the news. An attempt had been made on divine Caesar's life. I must say that Claudia seemed deeply shocked, though from that day to this, the people of Rome have believed that she and her brother had hired bullies to waylay and assassinate their guest. I left at once, and I found Caesar sitting in a courtyard being treated for his wounds. The physician was washing and binding these with sea moss, while Caesar sat there jesting.
Good physician, make haste. I shall be late to dinner.
Hail, Caesar, I came as quickly as I could.
Asinius, you are welcome. We shall not be long, I promise you. There, have you finished?
Sire, I now ask of you absolute quiet in sleep. Will the dictator graciously drink this opiate?
Good physician, I shall obey you in 2 hours. First, Asinius and I have an errand to perform nearby.
Sire, you must not.
I tell you that I must. Asinius, my wife and aunt dare not venture forth again, but you and I must keep our dinner engagement with Lady Claudia Pulcra and her guests.
As you wish, sire.
Here, my friend. Have you seen this leaflet?
Let me look at it. To every Roman worthy of his ancestors, prepare to shake off tyranny. Death to Caesar. Yes, master, I have seen these. They are scattered all about the city.
The men who attacked me have been captured, and with them a dozen of these pamphlets.
Signed, the Committee of 20.
Yes. My secret police, for all their interesting methods, have not been able to arrest this committee, but at least we know the author of the pamphlet. His rooms were searched and the original copies found there.
Who is this man?
The young poet we are going to meet this evening.
Not Catullus.
That is his name. You understand now why I am so eager to make his acquaintance?
Sire, let me imprison him. Put him to the torture.
No, I have reasons for wanting him alive. Give me your arm, Asinius. Centurion, have your soldiers go before and clear the Palatine way.
As we drew near to Claudia's house, we could see that the police were trying to disperse the crowd. Caesar walked toward them smiling, and when they saw him, a cry went up.
Romans! May the gods preserve Rome and all who love her. Your enemies have attempted to take my life. But I am still among you, capable and earnest to serve your welfare. Return to your homes, draw your wives and your children about you, and give thanks to the gods. Then, sleep well. A measure of wheat shall be given to every father, that he and his may rejoice with me. Go quietly to your homes, my friends.
We went into the house where Clodia and Catulus stood waiting. The other guests, and with them her brother, had fled by the back door for fear of the mob.
Welcome, great Caesar.
My dear Clodia Pulcher, forgive me for being so very late. And I must apologize for the absence of my wife and aunt. They have been unavoidably detained.
I, too, must apologize for the absence of Clodius, my brother. He was unexpectedly called away.
She is. And this is Catulus, eh?
Yes. This is the poet. He is still here. He is always with me.
Good evening, dictator.
Good evening, poet. Claudia, surely the dinner is not all spoiled. You can order us one dish, and while it is prepared, we can begin without drinking.
It shall be done.
Asinius, fill our cups.
Yes, sire.
I see, Claudia, that you've prepared for dinner in the Greek manner. That is well. After we dine, we shall have a feast of talk. Also in the manner of the Greeks, for the company is well chosen, and there is no lack of subjects for discussion.
You are the master, Caesar. Let the music begin.
I poured the wine and dinner was begun. My opinion of Clodia Pulcher had never been as harsh as that held by the majority of our community. And never did I have occasion to admire her more than on that evening. Her house was in disorder. Her brother had fled, and she herself lay under suspicion of having planned the attempt on the dictator's life. Yet she remained serene. Her famous beauty seemed enhanced by the danger she was in. Finally, the tables were withdrawn, and Caesar arose and placed a garland on his head.
The subject of our symposium shall be whether great poetry is the work of men's minds only, or, as some have claimed, it is the prompting of the gods. Now, before we begin, let us hear some verses that we may be reminded of the matter before us. Catulus, you are a poet. You will read.
You know my verses, Caesar?
I know them all by heart.
They are not always kind to Caesar.
No.
You are not angry?
I am not angry. Come, 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 boy. Recite to us.
What shall it be, then?
Well, speak for me the verses that begin, O immortal gods, if pity be...
O immortal gods, if pity be among your attributes, or if ever you have brought supreme aid to one already at the point of death, turn your eyes upon me, a most wretched man. And if I have lived a pure life, tear out from my heart this plague, this pestilence, which, stealing like a lethargy throughout my deepest fibers, has driven all joy from my breast. I no longer ask that this woman return my love. Nor, for that is impossible, that she be chaste. All I aspire to is that I be healed, and that this black malady be removed. O immortal gods, grant this in return for my devotion.
Well done, my boy, well done. You speak most movingly. And now, dear Claudia, the first speech of the evening falls to you.
So be it. If it be true, O Caesar, that poetry comes among us at the prompting of the gods, and we are indeed miserable. For poetry puts a fairer face on life than life can claim to. It is the most seductive of lies and the most treacherous of counselors.
No.
Be quiet, boy. Let us speak.
Without poetry to beguile them, men would go into battle. Brides would enter marriage. Wives would become mothers, and men would bury their dead and themselves in misery and discord. But drunk on poetry, men and women rush toward these events with I know not what unbounded expectations. Now it is very certain that poetry is only flattery. It puts to sleep the springs of action. It is an evil. It weakens weakness and it redoubles misery.
I will not allow you to say such things.
Hush, boy, let us speak.
And as be the poets, feverish dreamers,
poets are men like ourselves, but they are ill and suffering. I pity and despise them.
I must praise you for your eloquence, Claudia. But you have made our young friend angry. And since I disagree with you, I shall answer for him by telling you the legend of Alcestis. Now, everyone knows that Alcestis, wife of Admetus, king of Thessaly, was the golden pattern of all wives. As a girl, however, marriage was the last thing she wanted. Her heart was filled with one ambition, to become a priestess of Apollo at Delphi. One day, a soothsayer revealed to her that by the will of Jupiter, Apollo had come to live on Earth as a man among men. And Apollo had chosen to live as a herdsman outside her very gate. Toward the end of that day, when the stars were first appearing, Alcestis slipped from the palace and went to where five herdsmen were sitting about a fire. She stood at the edge of the firelight and besought Apollo to speak to her and answer the question that was her very life. The shepherds were bewildered. Finally, the oldest of them spoke and said, "Princess, if there be a god here, I do not know which it is. For 30 days we have walked together, drunk from the same wineskin, slept by the same fire, yet, lady, this I shall say, these are no ordinary herdsmen. That fellow there that's asleep, there's no illness he can't cure, snake bite or broken bones, yet in one town a child lay dying, and he would not cross the road to save her. So I know well that he's no god. And that fellow beside him, that one, you there, can't you stop drinking while the princess is looking at you? He never loses his way. In the darkest night, he knows his north from his south. But that is his only talent, and I know well that he is not the god of the sun. And the red-haired one, he is no ordinary herdsman either. He performs miracles and wonders. He makes water fall from the treetops, and balls of fire race along the ground. But he is ashamed of his tricks and knows not how he does them. Would a god be ashamed of his miracles? But Alcestis would not be put off so easily. She pointed to the fourth herdsman. That man, said the old one, he is our singer. Believe me, when he plays his lyre and sings, lions hang suspended in their leap. He can fill us to the brim with joy or sorrow when we have no reason to either rejoice or grieve. He can make the memory of love more tender than love itself. And then...
Yes, Caesar, go on. What happened then?
Caesar, are you in?
The herdsman said, but he soon rejects the song he has made. He loses joy in the thing he has done. And Alcestis cried, This is Apollo! This is the god! I can't go on. I'm ill, Asinius. Please take me home. Take me...
Master!
He had scarcely said the words when Caesar fell to the floor in a convulsion of pain. Whether from the wound he had had or from the fevers that his brain was sometimes subject to, I cannot say. When the agony was over and he fell into a deep sleep, I heard the poet say,
"Why did you lie to me about this man? Why did you teach me to hate him? I know him now, and he is a different man than I thought him to be."
We watched beside Caesar for a time, then placed him in his litter, and the poet and I accompanied him to his home.
And the poet and I accompanied him to his home. That is the account of the banquet as set down by Asinius. And now, before I begin the second part of my lecture, I should like to put my notes in order. So if any of you would care to take a moment or two and step outside for a smoke, you may feel free to do so.
Yeah, he's a funny old coot, but it's an interesting lecture.
You think so?
Yeah.
Frankly, I'm bored to death. I don't know why I ever took this course. Let's go out and have a smoke.
Okay.
From Hollywood, the NBC University Theater is bringing you Henry Hull in a radio version of Thornton Wilder's The Ides of March. If you are interested in supplementing your enjoyment of these NBC University Theater productions with home study under college supervision, be sure to listen to the announcement at the close of this program. And now, our intermission commentator, Dr. Beaumont Brustel, poet, playwright, and professor of English at the University of Tulsa. Dr. Brustel.
It is inevitable that writing men should have been and should be concerned with the complexities, the monumental and legendary complexities, of the greatest dictator the world has ever known, Julius Caesar. Almost from the time of Caesar, this has been so. The two greatest English dramatists have tackled Julius Caesar. These two are Shakespeare and Shaw. Shaw has come off brilliantly from the fray, Shakespeare with only mediocre success. His play about Caesar doesn't belong to Caesar at all. Now, a contemporary American writer, Thornton Wilder, has undertaken to tell the story of Julius Caesar in a novel titled From Caesar's Death Day, The Ides of March. The novel first appeared in 1948 and has since been something of a field of controversy for Wilder fans. Whether or not The Ides of March is Wilder's greatest novel is of little importance. What matters is that it is one of the most philosophically profound of the studies of Julius Caesar and one of the most sympathetic. Wilder has shown us that Caesar is fierce, kind, gentle, theatrical, wonderfully self-controlled in spite of his desperate epilepsy, wistful, religiously skeptical, a man philosophically accustomed to being hated, and a profound lover of great poetry. To Caesar, the best of life is the poetry of life. As a result, this man is a practical man who is also a kind of mystic. Next in importance to Caesar in the book is Claudia Pulcher, who is not customarily associated with Caesar in our minds. The genius of Wilder makes her into a remarkable woman, a woman who suffers a poisoned life, a woman with a snake in her soul. Cleopatra is slightly third-rate after this, but in a lesser study, she, too, would seem extraordinary. Caesar's wife is all that is to be expected, silly and inadequate and indulged by Caesar. This is the more remarkable when we consider that, as one of Caesar's servants truthfully says, quote, he is always right and she is always wrong. The Ides of March is, in but little sense of the word, a theatrical book, but it is a dramatic book, dramatic in its search under the skins of the characters for the torments and the doubts and the self-seekings that battle there. There are, as a result, few great scenes in the book in a theatrical sense, but the entire book is filled from page to page with the inner turmoil of people, some of whom, Caesar, Claudia, Caesar's aunt, briefly seen, are great people. It is because of the characters that we are able to get excited over the Ides of March, but it is also because of the beauty of speech in which the book is written. Few writers today have Wilder's wonderful gift for putting together words with equal grace and meaning, and Wilder has rarely put words together more gracefully or more meaningfully than in The Ides of March, which may turn out to be, after more years have passed over it, one of the great books of our time.
Thank you, Dr. Brustow. Our radio version of The Ides of March, starring Henry Hull, will continue from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
No, Caesar's mind was still occupied with the poet Catullus, for whom he had conceived a special fondness. For example, take this passage. Turnus, word has reached me in a very indirect way that the poet has been ill, or at least in extreme distress of mind. Now, isn't that an interesting comment? Few politicians nowadays are much concerned about the welfare of poets. But further on, we find him saying, I think at last we have found in this Catullus the greatest of Roman poets. And I say to you in all gravity
that one of the things in this world that I most envy is the endowment from which springs great poetry. I count great poetry the topmost achievement of man's powers. Oh, to be understood by such an one as Catullus, and to be celebrated by his hand in verses that would not soon be forgotten. And yet he has chosen to glorify Claudia Pulcher, to waste his life and his song for the favors of a harlot whose beauty now, because of him, shall be immortal. Not long ago, there was a plot against my life. And since that time, although against my wishes, the secret police have posted spies within her house. Thus I have come to see reports about their quarrels. She upbraids him constantly and treats him as if he were a child. She has often called into his face an hysterical child.
It is too boring to have to deal with an hysterical child. Never try to see me again.
You have betrayed me. Broken your promise.
I will not be spoken to in such a fashion. I have broken no promises because I made none. I shall live as I choose.
You have always been unfaithful. You have always lied to me.
You know that I never lie, and that I do not permit people to tell lies in my presence. I've been, as you call it, unfaithful to you on numerous occasions. I do not sleep well at night, and so I arrange for companionship.
Oh, Claudia, forgive me. Listen to me this once.
Let us go to the country together. We'll be happy there. We shall read. We shall walk by the sea. And there'll be no others there.
I tell you that there shall always be others. So let us say goodbye. Goodbye, Catullus. Put me forever out of your mind. Go and do not come to see me again.
No.
All I ask of you is that you go. I want to be rid of all poets and weaklings. Love is a sickness with you, and I have no patience with the sick.
Yes, I am sick with love. A love like mine must speak, it must cry out. Claudia, I have worshipped you, made a goddess of you.
Are you insane? From now on, I forbid you my house. You are not to come here again.
Oh, please. Please, we'll speak no more. I did not mean to make you so angry. Forget the cutting things that we have said to one another. You call me sick. I am. I have been ill. Despised lovers pretend that they are ill, but this is no pretense. Claudio, do you wish to kill me? If you no longer give me your love, then I shall surely die.
Die, then, die. I shall be glad. I shall be glad to see you die.
Then there is one thing I have left to do. I will insult the universe. I will insult it by making a beautiful thing. That I shall do. And then I'll put an end to this crucifixion that has been my life.
When you have done this, I shall think that you were a man.
I have seen reports of what has been said there in that house. Poets before have told us of their sufferings and have been cured. But I have reason to believe the Catullus cannot be cured. He has resigned all hope of health and is letting himself drift into death.
He is letting himself drift into death. Now, students, doesn't that suggest to you that the dictator of all Rome was a man of pity and compassion? But now, a word about Cleopatra, the witch of the Nile. As I have said, she and Caesar were something more than friends. Cleopatra, although a deceitful, intriguing person and a light-hearted murderess, was nevertheless a remarkable girl with an active mind, a nimble wit, and a genius for administration. It was therefore altogether proper that her arrival in Rome should be celebrated with a magnificent reception. But there was, so to speak, one fly in the ointment. Julius Caesar did not arrive at his appointed hour. We have the word of Asinius Pollio, who says, "The dictator was late to the reception for the Queen of Egypt, and I observed this made her angry."
How is it that the great Caesar does not attend our banquet?
Majesty, I cannot say. I have no doubt that affairs of state have kept him at the capital.
If Her Majesty wishes. Yes. Who is this?
Allow me to present Your Majesty, the Lady Claudia Pulcher.
Yes, Your Ladyship. If Her Majesty pleases, I can tell her where Caesar may be found. Oh, and can you indeed? Yes, Majesty. A servant of mine has brought word that the dictator was seen an hour ago, sitting beside the sickbed of Catullus. And who is Catullus? He is a poet, Your Majesty. A revolutionist who has sometimes written verses against our Caesar. I find it hard to credit this report, my lady. That your leader should be in attendance at the sickbed of some versifier while I expect him here. This is discourteous of Caesar.
Your Majesty, doubtless there is some other explanation. Our great leader himself will be here soon, I'm sure, to offer his apology.
It is growing late. They've lighted all the torches. Who is to escort me to the water pageant? I am a queen. I am not used to this waiting. Your Majesty, if I may suggest, Caesar's nephew is close by. He has asked me to present him to you. He has been a great admirer of Your Majesty's beauty. Caesar's nephew, did you say? Yes. He is here, Majesty. Let me present him. Come forward, young man.
Your Majesty.
Yes. He is a fine young man. I am very glad to know him.
Your Majesty is most kind.
Will you take your uncle's place tonight and sit beside me on the throne?
I should be greatly honored.
Then you shall do so. What is your name, young man?
My queen, in Rome they call me Mark Antony.
I will remember. Take my arm, young man.
I am watching beside the bed of a dying friend, the poet Catullus. From time to time, he falls asleep. I then take up my pen and write, not as much to record my thoughts as to avoid reflection. Death is inevitable, and I can now tell at a glance those men who have not yet foreseen their death, and I know them for the children that they are. They think by evading the contemplation of death that they are enhancing the savor of life, but the reverse is true. Only those who are constantly aware of death and darkness are capable of praising the sunlight. Each year I say farewell to the spring with a more intense passion because I know my death is certain, nay, momently possible. Wait, Carlos is stirring. He's opened his eyes again. Now he will speak.
Caesar.
Yes, my friend.
Will you read to me my mother's letter? It is by my bedside.
I should be glad.
She is a very simple woman, my mother. A good woman.
I understand, my boy. I'll read it to you. It says, your father has taken on many new duties in the town. He is busy from morning to night. The crops have not been what was expected. Your sister, Ipsithia, had a very bad cold, but is better. Your dogs are well. All Verona knows your poems by heart. Why do you never send them to us? Sicinius' wife brought over 20 of them to us. It is strange that we must receive from a neighbor's hand the one you wrote about your dear brother's death. Your father carries it with him wherever he goes. I pray daily that the immortal gods may protect you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Another hour has gone by. He is asleep again. You know that I am no stranger to deathbeds. I know what one must do. To those in pain, one talks about themselves. To those in clear mind, one praises the world that they are quitting. There is no dignity in leaving a despicable world, and the dying are often fearful lest life was not worth the effort it had cost them. Yes, I never short of subjects to praise. He is awake again.
Caesar?
I am here.
Caesar, have I lived in vain? Have I wasted my life?
No. No, you've written great poetry, Catullus. And the true poet is a country's highest ornament. You have not lived in vain.
Caesar, that night, do you remember?
Hmm?
When she wounded me, when she made mock of my verses in front of you.
Hmm.
In front of you, Caesar.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Do you remember?
Yes, Catullus, I know she is no ordinary woman. There is a greatness about her. And she will be remembered because of you.
I have done well to praise her.
Yes, you have done well.
She has been badly hurt. When one has been hurt very badly, one can do cruel things.
Who has hurt her?
You, Caesar.
I?
Yes. I've always known it. It's you she loves. She has not forgotten that you loved her once. And so she sought revenge through me.
Can this be true?
That is why I've hated you. That is why I wrote the things I did denouncing you. I have been jealous of you, Caesar.
Oh, no.
I, jealous of you. Oh, it was foolish.
Tell me, Catullus, who are these friends of yours? Who is this committee of 20?
All those letters were written by me alone. There is no committee of 20. I have failed in all things.
No, my boy, I assure you. There, you did not fail. Those bulletins of yours have done their damage. Hundreds of thousands have been aroused to patriotic hatred of me, the oppressor. My secret police arrest them every day.
Oh, forgive me. I am sorry for this, for I respect you, Caesar.
You must rest now, my poor friend.
You will not go away?
No. No, I shall be here. He is sleeping. And during this last hour, I have paid my debt. He has been comforted at least. I have emptied my heart of thanks and praise to him. But if only I could communicate all that I owe to men like this, all my life long, boy and man, soldier and administrator, lover, father, son, sufferer and rejoicer. All the happiness I owe to the genius of poetry, all the wisdom and courage such men have given me, sustained me in despair, kept me alive to beauty and the joy of life. These are our poets. Many things remain unspoken. And now, Catullus too is dead.
And now, Catullus too is dead. Historians have demonstrated that Caesar arrived quite late to Cleopatra's reception. So late, in fact, that he surprised the Queen of Egypt in the arms of Mark Antony. Now, the Ides of March are drawing on apace. On December 12 of the same year, Julius Caesar divorced his wife, Pompeia. And the circumstance came about in this fashion. Note the following letter sent to Turinus on the 10th day of the month. I emerged from my bedchamber this morning to the music of women's voices. Last night, as you know, had occurred the ceremonies
of the sacred mysteries of the good goddess, from time immemorial, the exclusive annual religious function, conducted and attended by our Roman matrons of high birth. No man, not even I, has ever been allowed to see these secret rites or to penetrate the sanctum of this holy ceremonial. Of course, the ritual goes on most of the night, so I wasn't in the least surprised that my wife and aunt had visitors this early in the morning.
This is the end. Really, our most beautiful and sacred ceremony dragged into the mud.
I know, my dear Alina. If I hadn't seen him there with my own eyes, I'd never have believed it.
Well, personally, I think it's rather funny.
Pompeia, dear, you mustn't say such things.
Julia, if your nephew Caesar had any proper respect for religion or the old Roman way of life, instead of wasting his time on these newfangled irrigation projects and flood control...
Now, Alina... We all know your views on those subjects. The question now is, what shall be done with Clodia Pulcher and her brother?
Good morning, ladies. What of Clodia Pulcher?
Oh, Kai.
Good morning, nephew.
Good morning, great Caesar.
What is all this excitement? Don't tell me. Don't tell me that someone has abducted the Vestal Virgins.
Oh, a most terrible thing has happened, nephew. Last night, Clodia Pulcher introduced her brother, dressed as a votary, into the ceremonies of the good goddess.
What? You mean in woman's costume?
Oh, you should have seen him, dear. Really, he made quite an attractive woman.
It has set religion back 1,000 years.
It's an outrage to Roman motherhood.
Now tell me quite calmly, Aunt Julia, exactly how it happened.
Why, Caius, our singing had been going on for an hour, and the responses. Then suddenly he was recognized.
Some women flew at him and tore off his turban and veil.
Soon women were striking him from all sides. Others dashed about covering up the sacred things.
Poor Clodius. The way they scratched his pretty face.
Now really, Pompeia, the way you keep pitying the brute, one would think you were on his side.
Well, Clodius didn't mean any harm. It was just his idea of a joke.
It is not a matter to joke about, Pompeia.
I quite agree, Aunt Julia. I promise you that I shall start a thorough investigation of this matter as soon as I get to the capital. Oh. Goodbye, ladies.
Well, good day.
Goodbye, nephew.
Goodbye, my wife.
Oh, bye-bye, Caius, darling. Bye-bye.
Asinius, I suppose our secret police have kept the usual day-to-day reports on the activities of Clodius Pulcher.
Yes, Dictator.
Bring them here to me.
I have them ready. I was afraid that you would ask for them this morning.
Why do you say you were afraid?
Read them, Caesar, and you will see.
Yes. Yes, I do see, Asinius. Why wasn't this sorry matter pointed out to me before?
Great Caesar, none of us has dared to tell you.
And it is verified that Clodius has visited my house in my absence on each of these occasions?
It is verified. And he wore the disguises provided for by his sister, as it is reported.
Well, Asinius. I have survived the Gallic Wars and the campaigns in Africa. I dare say I can survive the faithlessness of woman. I've known a great many women in my life, Asinius.
Yes, Dictator.
One marriage in 100 is happy, my friend. This is one of those things which everyone knows and which no one says.
Yes, Dictator.
Given the nature of women and the nature of the passion which draws men and women together, what chance does marriage have of being happy? By marrying, we place our households into the hands of women, and they extend their control, as far as they are able, over all our goods. Women wish only the warmth of a hearth and the shelter of a roof, and to protect this property, there is no deception, nor rapacity to which they will not resort. All that they ask of a home beyond its shelter is that it be more ostentatious than that of a neighbor's wife. All that they ask for their children's happiness is that they be wealthily married.
There is much truth in what you say.
Sinis, I believe wives consciously dread and despise their husbands, and bring up their daughters to live in such fear and contempt of men that most girls remain ignorant, joyless, and brutified all their days. Look at me. I've constantly been victimized by women who have been made stupid by the greed and prejudice of their mothers. A man may have saved the state, directed the affairs of a world, and acquired an undying fame for wisdom, but to his wife, he is still a witless fool. Oh, Pompeo, why did you do it?
I am full of sadness, Caesar, that I should have been the bearer of these tidings.
Yes. Yes, well, I'm rid of her. You may issue an edict in my name saying that I shall divorce my wife tomorrow afternoon.
It shall be done.
My friend, let us console ourselves with philosophy. That is a realm which women have never entered, indeed, in which they have never taken the faintest interest. And let us welcome that old age which frees us from the desire for their embraces. Embraces which must be paid for at the cost of all order in our lives and any tranquility in our minds.
Fortunately, I have reached that age.
But, alas, I have not. Now, what further business do we have before us?
The woman, Clodia Pulcher, has been brought as you directed.
Let her come in.
Yes, Dictator.
Please step inside.
You sent for me, mighty Caesar?
Yes. It is with regret that I must tell you, Clodia, that appeals have been lodged with me which urge that you and your brother be excluded from the city of Rome.
Where is my brother? What have you done with him?
Well, he's under the care of my physician and unable to be moved at the present time. As you know, he happened to get into the path of some angry women. Now, you know what cruelty women are capable of.
The cruelty of women? That is a slur at me, isn't it? Because of Catullus...
You're touchy on that subject.
The only reason for which you punish me is that I refuse my love to the poet.
No blame attaches to a woman who, being loved, is unable to love in return. But a woman knows well the ways in which she may intensify or mitigate the sufferings of her lover. And neither the persuasion of reason nor the appeal to mercy altered your conduct toward him. His gifts to Rome were of no less consequence than mine.
Punish me, then.
You and your brother hereby are banished from Rome. You are not to return under penalty of death.
I loved you once.
And I was once in love with you. Your real punishment, Clodia, is yet to come, and exile is the least of it. In a year or two, your beauty will be gone, and that, for a woman of your kind, is the hardest punishment of all. You may go now.
This is goodbye, then. You despise me. I understand that. But you have a responsibility toward me. You made me what I am. You, a monster, have made me a monster. I can endure my life in exile because I know that I shall be revenged. I have planted the seeds of rebellion. I've sharpened their knives, and I shall be revenged. And it will not be long. Hail and farewell, great Caesar. Health and long life to the dictator. And so I say, goodbye.
Asinius, what other business do we have?
There is a gift that has come, and with it a note from the Queen of Egypt.
Another note? Here, let me see. Oh, yes, the usual. She begs my forgiveness. It was not her fault. The ardent Antony compromised her by blandishment and force and so forth and so forth. Oh. And where's the gift?
Here, Dictator.
Hmm? Oh, yes, 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 yes. The juice of juniper berries mixed with wormwood and honey. It's an old Egyptian remedy, and Phineas, guaranteed to cure baldness. It will keep your head purple for a week. Do you have your stylus?
Yes, Caesar.
And write me down a note to be delivered to the Queen of Egypt. My dear Cleopatra, you are long since forgiven for your indiscretion. I know my nephew's habits very well, and thank you, my pearl, my lotus, for the magic salve you have sent me. Now, I am neither a doctor nor a magician, but this one thing I know. A man can have either hair or brains, but he can't have both. I'm quite handsome enough as I am, and since the immortal gods gave me good sense, I think they didn't mean for me to have curls. I'm sending you my star and phoenix, a bottle of Syrian perfume, and since I am disengaged, I shall call at your villa later in the evening. You still have my heart. There is no woman in the world who can compare with the great queen of Egypt.
There is no woman in the world who can compare with the great queen of Egypt. And now a fragment of the last letter written to Turnus on the morning of the 15th day, the Ides of March, in the year 44 B.C. It begins, by the immortal gods, I
am angry. Each day new plots against me are discovered. It is charged that I am a thief of liberty, monster of greed, and murderer of the Republic. In the eyes of my enemies, there is no good in me. I had a dream of death last night, the same dream that has come to me many times before. In it, the dead call out to me in mockery from their grave clothes, and generations still unborn cry out in agony and pain. Life, life has this mystery that we dare not say whether it is good or bad, senseless or controlled. When I regard the clownish parade of mortal life, I sometimes wonder if the universe knows that we are here. Flood of folly, fire or madness may destroy us at any time, and yet there is a pattern. I have for many years, dear friend Turinus, had your example to profit by. Since the day that you were wounded, I have been nourished by your wisdom and your patience and your gaiety of heart. There must be purpose in a world that can provide us with examples of such courage. My wife, Cleopatra, my wife, Calpurnia, has advised me not to go to the Senate today. The wild winds of March are blowing, and with them fly the customary rumors of plots and counterplots. But I shall go to the Senate. I am expected there sharp on the hour, and I must not be late.
Here Caesar's last letter breaks off. We have the account of his assassination, of course, handed down by Suetonius. When he saw that he was surrounded on all sides by drawn daggers, he wrapped his head in his robe, at the same time drawing the folds about his feet with his left hand. One of the caskers plunged a dagger into him, just below the throat, and when he tried to rise, he was held down by another stab. In this manner, then, he was stabbed 23 times. He said no word, merely groaned at the first stroke. But when Marcus Brutus fell upon him, he said in Greek, "You too, my son." All the conspirators took themselves off and left him lying there, dead. Well, as I said to begin with, it is by no means certain that these letters are genuine. But they are interesting, and I offer them for what they are worth. Thank you for your attention.
I am sure we're all grateful to Professor Willard for coming here today. May I remind you to pass out to the rear of the hall. Oh, yes, the administration wishes me to announce that there will be a football rally tonight in the gymnasium.
You have been listening to The Ides of March, an NBC University Theater production of the novel by Thornton Wilder, starring Henry Hull as Caesar. If you wish to expand your knowledge, you might enjoy the college-supervised courses now being offered in connection with the NBC University Theater. These courses are offered by the University of Tulsa in Oklahoma, Kansas State Teachers College, and the University of Louisville. For full information as to how you may enhance your knowledge through these home study courses, write to NBC University Theater, in care of the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky, the University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas. Let me repeat that. For full information, write to NBC University Theater, in care of the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky, the University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas. Next week, be with us again at the NBC University Theater. At that time, we will bring you a dramatization of one of the best-loved books of our time, James Hilton's gently beautiful novel, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, starring as Mr. Chips, Herbert Marshall. And the following week, a radio version of J.P. Marquand's current bestseller, Point of No Return. The Ides of March was prepared for radio by Brainerd Duffield and Emerson Crocker. Starred as Julius Caesar was Mr. Henry Hull. Our cast included Charles Seal, Harley Bear, Georgia Backus, Doris Singleton, Jan Arvan, Lynn Allen, Ben Wright, Maya Gregory, Larry Dobkin, Ida Reese-Marin. Your announcer, Don Stanley. Our intermission commentator was Dr. Beaumont Brustel, whose commentary was recorded. The original music score was composed and conducted by Dr. Albert Harris. The director of the NBC University Theater is Andrew C. Love. This program came to you from Hollywood. This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.